Hi, everyone. My name is Benno Papari, and this is the Songwriters on Process podcast. Since 2010, I've interviewed over 300 songwriters about, well, their songwriting process. I don't care about favorite cities, tour stories, favorite foods, or anything like that. My goal has always been to treat songwriters the same way that we treat poets and more traditional prose writers. They are writers, plain and simple. In these interviews, we go deep into the specifics of the writing process. This is no, hey, do you start with the lyrics of the music type of interview. Now, a little bit about me. I'm not a songwriter. In fact, I've never written a song in my life. I have a PhD in English language and literature, and I'm a former academic. So as a prose writer, I enjoy exploring how my process intersects with those of songwriters. This is an intelligent conversation about writing between two writers. And that, of course, means we talk a lot about books. The site features interviews across all genres, from metal to jazz, from country to that big category known as indie. You'll find a couple of A-list actors on the site and several members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as well. Now, I select songwriters to interview who fit into one of two categories. One, do I listen to them already? And two, if I don't, would they make for a compelling and intelligent interview? You can find these interviews across all podcast platforms, as well as at songwritersonpodcast.com. Do you have an idea for an interview or a comment about the site? Hit me up at ben@songwritersonprocess.com. Thanks for listening and enjoy. And today's episode is with Devendra Banhart. Banhart's new album, Flying Wig, comes out September 22nd. This was a fun interview. I love all my interviews. Some of them, though, are more straightforward. You know, not a lot of jokes, and that's totally fine. Those are great, too, and that depends on the personality of the person I'm talking to. But we had fun. A lot of laughing, a lot of back and forth banter. It was more, I think, the wonderment of the process. I think the best way to describe it is we're trying to seek a truth of what creativity is and where this comes from and kind of probing. It was less me asking questions and more a conversation and him asking me questions and us talking about things and trying to get to where ideas come from. We have no answer, but it was more of a journey. A couple of things to note, though. I mean, it's as fun as this interview was, and, you know, there are so many pull quotes in this that I could just, take out. One of the ones that really blew my mind was when he said, if you're writing alone, you're still collaborating. Now, think about that. If you're writing alone, you're still collaborating. So even if, you know, there's no one else around, there's that voice in your head when you're writing. That you know, whether it's a critic or anything like that, but you know, you're just not spewing the words forth on the page. They're not pouring out. There's some measure of deliberation. So you are collaborating. You are writing with yourself. And that kind of blew my mind when he said it. And it's one of those things where I think, wow, I probably will always remember that, but that's a great idea. The other thing you can't see in this, because obviously it's a podcast, is once again, we talked a lot about books, a lot about poetry. It is deeply distressing to me how few songwriters, or people, I guess, in general, read poetry. Just so few songwriters I've interviewed, although I have had a spate of luck recently of those who are fans of poetry. But we talked about the importance of poetry, not just to the world, but also to songwriters and why poetry plays a major role in his life. He reads every day. He writes every day. In fact, what I was saying was what you can't see. I do these interviews over Zoom. Was behind him was floor to ceiling bookshelf, nothing but books behind him. And, I've done, close to 400 of these interviews, and it's pretty clear to me the through line of great lyrics and reading. It's impossible to be a good writer if you don't read. But we frantically exchanged book titles too. But again, I think, you know, what really struck me was the importance of poetry. And how that's important, not just to us as a society, but also, and I know that just sounds like an old fashioned thing to say, but how songwriters can benefit from poetry. And we talked about a lot about literature, but anyway, great conversation. I hope the fun comes out in this. Again, Banhart's interview, Banhart's new album, Flying Wig, comes out September 22nd. And with that, my interview with Devendra Banhart. Let's get started.
Let's talk about songwriting. Let's talk about songwriting. Please, you go.
Yeah, well, you know, I always
thank you. Thanks for taking the time. It means a lot. I don't take it for granted. I'm honored to be a part of this.
Yeah, really, well, good. Really? You know, my first question I usually start with is it important to you to create in some fashion every day? I mean, some songwriters tell me no. Do it when you feel the need. Some say no, the discipline has to be there. You've got to create in some fashion every day, regardless of how good it is.
Well, I remember as a kid reading something, it was a lot to do with Michael Girard from this band, from Swans and the Angels of Light, yeah. And watching Michael go to work as a songwriter. You know, I was 18. I was 21 when that record came out, but I was 18 when I sent it over to him. And I moved to Brooklyn. And I didn't have any plan. I just knew that this was a time to just really give it a shot, really go for it. And that meant living in a really... I couldn't even imagine today. I found my bed in the garbage because there'd been that bed bug infestation. And so there's this beds everywhere and I didn't even think of it. I just thought, oh, I need a bed. So I'll just grab it from the dump. I'm not kidding. But that's an illustration of how much I was just going for it and not really trying to do anything other than make enough money I was a busboy at Angelica Kitchen to just get some food, even though I also scraped the food off of the people we weren't eating. Things I wouldn't be shocked of today. I don't even like shaking people's hands. I'm a fist bumper way before the pandemic. It's disgusting shaking someone's hand just because, you know, I know what I do with my hands. My God. And I go to the men's bathroom. Nobody washes their fucking hands. Point is, all that is to say that I remember when I first moved to New York and I'm meeting Michael Girard. I was a huge fan of Swans, Angels of Light. And I watched, we get eventually just like hanging out all the time and I'm seeing his process. And his process was, okay, I wake up, I've got my rituals, I've got my things, and now I'm going to the office. And the office is just a room with a desk and a guitar and a pen and paper. And he's just sitting there writing the song, beating his head against the wall until something emerges. And then that's it. Okay, that's five, done. Let's take a break. It doesn't really ever end. You're still kind of always looking and thinking about the song, but the first formulation of it, I think my whole point is that I related so much more to sitting down and having the discipline to give attention to something as opposed to waiting for this inspiration thing to happen. And I remember when I was much younger, I was 14, reading like Paul McCartney Has a Dream and wakes up and he's just playing Yesterday. I was, my gosh, that's so magical to hear that, yeah. Right? It doesn't, it definitely captivates your imagination. You go, whoa, that's what songwriting can be like, that, this thing that arrives, like, whoa. But it never happened to me. I never woke up with a song. I have dreamt of a disco song and I thought this would be good, but I didn't remember it when I woke up. But that kind of thing of, you know, it requires treating it not like a job, but having the discipline to give attention until something starts to emerge was really big for me. And I'm so, it's amazing. I think of people, I don't even know what is inspiration. I get inspired to work. It's not like the inspiration makes the thing happen.
Well, for me, there's a sense of anxiety. If I don't write for a few days, or also if I don't read, because I think that I can't be a writer unless I read. It's not possible. And I there's an anxiety after a few days when I haven't done those things. And I feel like I really should be doing those things. So for me, it's also just anxiety. If I haven't created or read, that's what drives me there. So if you're not in that space for a few days, do you get that growing anxiety?
I try to write one line a day.
Okay.
So every day you got to have one, just a little drop in the bucket every day. And I think you understand what I mean. That's, I was trying to get to that where I'm not waiting for this aha moment. I know what the song is. Every day I contribute a little bit to this mysterious thing, to this investigation. What is this going to be about? Maybe there's some image, maybe there's something, but in order to get to that kind of that landscape where all the materials are there and it's about arranging them in a certain way or shaping the form of it, that requires, I think, a daily contribution to what that might look like. So on my desk, there's always a little notebook. And yeah, reading is a big part of my day. There's also, every single day, something needs to be read. And it's, a big part of the day. And it's typically in the morning, it's something more on the, maybe let's say the spiritual side and some poetry. So that's like morning time. You got to have those things kind of work hand in hand, and they definitely shake up the way my mind just works in this normal, boring human way. I read a little poetry. I go, whoa, okay. I can see things are, it reminds me of how useful and magical it is, to have poetry in my life as a way of observing the world, as a way of how it relates to my work. So you got to write a little thing every single day. And it could just be, I'm not writing anything down right now. You could write that down.
Yeah. So I'm distressed by the number of songwriters. I could probably count on one hand the number who say they read poetry. I mean, you're honestly in such a tiny minority of songwriters who tell me they read poetry. And I think that should be a natural. I mean, the way this word sound, there's so much, even if there's no music involved. So yeah, I guess the two-part question, do you have certain poets you go to? I certainly do. And why is that important to you as a songwriter? Not just for the experience of reading, but also maybe how it influences your songs.
Well, first, I'd love to hear about who are your go-tos. And I have some go-tos, but right now it's about always having a new book of poetry in rotation. So at this moment, it's Jack Gilbert's
Collected
Poems. And then prior to that, I think it might have been Ted Hughes or Louise Gluck. Yeah. Oh, and Scott Momaday's The Death of City.
Oh, yeah.
Too. Yeah.
I've read stuff by him, but I think prose. Oh, gosh. What did I read? I've read stuff by him, and I think I forgot what it was. It escapes me. But my two favorites, I got a few favorites. Lee Young Lee is fantastic, and Galway Kinnell. I have been fortunate to see both of them. Galway Kinnell, when he was alive, I saw him read. Lee Young Lee, I saw him read. And I was at, Powell's bookstore, I think. There was a poster. I think it's Powell's. There's a signed poster, one of Galway Kinnell's poems. It's a giant, like 18 by 24, and it's signed by him. And I bought it. I remember buying it, and I got very emotional. I've got actually tears in my eyes as I'm buying this. And the guy's probably like, what are you doing, man? Just, why? And it was so powerful. I didn't realize the impact it would have on me to see his signature on there.
Yeah. Those are fetishes. Those are powerful fetishes.
Powerful.
And I think that's why I'm sorry.
No, please go ahead.
Well, why it's there's the utilitarian element to reading poetry every day. So you've got Galway Kinnell, their work means so much to you, and you've got this connection with their signature there. That's also very encouraging. So we would have these like support systems. And if you're writing every day and you know that you don't want to write every day, I certainly don't. I fucking definitely don't. But you know that that's so important. You know that you have the day. It's impossible. You build a life where it's impossible to not write one line. And those items, either the signature or the practice of also reading a little poetry every day, will encourage and make sure that you do that. Because it's funny how it quickly overgrown that terrain will get if you don't cultivate it, right? And I'm not necessarily even, that's why it's always new poetry or something that I read. I mean I've got like a subscription to the Paris Review, and now and then there'll be new poems in there and I'll go out, check this person out. Usually that's the one poem I like, but in the whole book. Yeah. But I'll get that, I'll order it and I'll get the book, and then it's in the road and I'll really try to read the whole thing. And all of that is serving to either, well, be what poetry can be at its highest form, which is just as powerful as the best movie you've ever seen, made you want to live. So a good poem will definitely do that. I mean, really do that, but that's rare. Or it'll remind you of how poetry can alter your consciousness. It really can. And mm-hmm. and it's almost like putting on this machine or this mechanism, this something that changes the way you're perceiving the world. And yeah. So your whole attitude changes. You read, you go out, and of course this is it could be an inner exploration or an outer physical phenomenal exploration. Of course, and in reality, it's both of those things combined. And how you're perceiving the world is totally different if you have this poetry mindset. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. But that's what good poetry does. It lets you see something that you look at every day and you see it in a new way. And Galway Kinnell, when he writes about nature, I mean, he lived in the woods and writes about nature and things that you would see every day in nature. He writes about in a new way. And that's what's so powerful. And I'll go down there. It's downstairs and it's hanging, and I'll go down there and I'll read it all the time. And it's like every time I read it, no joke, I mean, every time I read it, I find something I didn't notice before. And that's the beauty of it.
I'm thinking of the fetishes, and I my pyjama shirt is a Mary Oliver shirt that I made.
Amazing.
You know, it's the only one. It's the only one that exists that I have. That's my shirt that I had made on some website that you can make runs of one. And it's my pyjama shirt.
And that's amazing.
And reminding you of thinking of nature and like the way that she writes about nature. I can't believe it. But then there's people like, Leonard Cohen does it too, where you go, I can't believe that you rhyme these two words that are so obvious that everyone that should have no more possible. You can't rhyme anymore these words. And you did it in a way that it's totally new to me. How did you do that?
Yeah.
The complicated thing said simply, or like this, basically getting to simplicity, which is also why haiku is so powerful, right? Here's an epic, an entire, generations can span in four lines. That's so incredible.
Yeah. That's why to me also novelists, there's a great book of fiction his name is Joe Wilkins, and he's a poet. He's a professor somewhere in the West, and his name is Joe Wilkins. I interviewed him for the site actually a few years ago, and his book is called Fall Back Down When I Die, and he lives in Montana and he's from there. And so the book is about, it's a work of fiction, but it's about the land use, land rights issues in the West and things like that. But anyway, when good poets write fiction, I mean, there's nothing better than that for me, because you're talking about a plot-driven book that's written with poetic imagery. And there's not many poets who write fiction too. But when they can, those are the best books to me.
That's beautiful. Yeah, that's something I really want to look into, actually, because I don't read that much fiction. And that crossover, you're right. That's really interesting. That's when a good writer, though. I mean, like, I've been reading, I just finished Sigrid Nunez's last book, and it's such a simple story, but each line, also Tokyo Ueno Station, if you ever read that.
No.
It's just so heartbreaking. When you can read, and that's the most beautiful thing about fiction. Yeah, I love a story. I love a narrative. I don't like vignettes. I don't even like vignettes. Like a TV show, it's like, oh, it's all vignettes. They're not tied together. I'm not even interested. You know, I want these, like, I love a long arc and like character development, the whole thing. I love it. But when somebody can just write one line that makes you want to reread it over and over again because it hits you so hard, and it's about a subway station or something so mundane, it's like deserves every award.
Yeah. We had at our wedding, someone read.
What did we have?
Yes.
I forgot. It was such a, I was so kind of nervous.
How could you have forgotten? we had the E. Cummings poem read, Somewhere I Have Never Traveled Gladly Beyond. And it's an amazing love poem. Oh. And so check that one out too. Nobody, not even the rain, has such small hands. That's the last line of the poem.
What a line.
It's beautiful.
Fine.
So, yeah. Good stuff. So, okay. So this one line, I'm interested. When you write this one line, are you done after? Is it, if you feel like you're getting somewhere, do you write more? Is it just, is that sense of accomplishment? No one's ever said, I just write one line. I've heard people say one page, two pages, half hour, but one line. Why the one line?
Well, it's one line minimum.
Okay.
Yeah. One line minimum. And it doesn't mean that I won't get more than one line. More often than not, it's only one line, but I got one line. And I go, okay. The day wasn't total failure. You know, there was something was happened today, some little movement. So it's this tiny little movements for me. I rarely, unless it's time to record, that's a very whole different thing. But up to the process of being like today's studio time begins, the record is being made. Everything is just accumulative. So it's just, what can I accumulate? What are the materials? And all you're hoping for is one line that feels good, feels new. That makes you feel like you're worth something in a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, I don't want to judge. And I so admire when I see somebody singing a show, playing a show, and it's all songs from decades ago. And it's that kind of show. And you're seeing, like, you know, a bad example is I just saw Tears for Fears play. It's a bad example because they played Everybody Wants to Rule the World 4 songs in. How bold is that? And then they said, and now we're going to play stuff on my new record. And that was fucking mind blowing. I loved that. And they're very aware that would have been probably really sad if they just played only the old songs, or they wait till the last minute to play Everybody Wants to Rule the World, or they just do new material. No one really want, they also want to hear these mega hits that they grew up on. So they did a really good job kind of balancing all of that out. But there's something about having a new song that, I guess that's my whole point, is I don't want to judge somebody who just like, here's the song I wrote 20 years ago and that's it. That's the whole set. It's all songs from 20 years ago. That's great. That's beautiful. I also think that's how amazing that your work is that good, that it's still exciting and inspiring to people and people still dig it. So that's totally commendable and admirable. But the feeling as a songwriter of having a new song is the most useful and the most confident myself I ever can be, and the most like my life is worth something feeling mm-hmm. that I have is the feeling of having a new song. I have some tether, I'm somehow tethered to the world having this new song. It's so important. I think it's when somebody asks me what matters to you in this context, without a doubt it's having a new song is what's really important to me. And it's at the cost of certain things, but the word sacrifice, you know, sacrifice is the root of that word is sacred office. So like having a kid, okay, so what a sacrifice. Well, actually, but it's also I don't have a kid, but I know from my friends that have kids, they don't sleep. They're miserable and it's like constant, but it's also the greatest thing in their lives. And that's what a real sacred office is. It should be something that it's because I'm using that as an example of what high sacred office. But for me, songwriting is that it's not fun. I'm never having fun. I'm never touring is never, wow, you haven't slept. You haven't eaten. You know what I mean? You're uncomfortable at all these things, more than uncomfortable, of course. But, and you know, songwriting just doesn't arrive. Doesn't just come. So none of it is like a pleasant, fun, easy thing, but it's the most important thing. And having a new song it's the only thing that really matters to me.
Yeah. So when you, I'm interested in speaking.
What was the question?
No, well, I'm not even sure
what it was. Was it about my favorite food? Yeah.
It was not your favorite food and your favorite tour story. So I'm big on the ritual of the process. So for example, if I may write in this chair, but I always revise in that chair behind me. But honestly, this is my workspace here. And I hate to have my workspace and my prose writing, which is different, in the same space. Well, I usually actually write downstairs. My point is, I'm big on recognizing what works and what doesn't. And, you know, and maybe that's a hindrance because it kind of restricts me, but I just don't like to do, I know that revising and writing shouldn't be in the same space. And I know that I need to associate that writing because like you, it's, you know, it can be difficult. I know that I've got to associate it with some kind of positive experience or positive environment. So how important is that ritual, speaking of Paris review interviews, because that's what they talk about. How important is that ritual, whether it's time of day?
Yeah, the dedicated space that you're describing. So important.
Yeah.
So important. And typically you want that to be a clean and beautiful space, a space that feels beautiful, that feels spacious. Doesn't have to be. It could be tiny, but the feeling of a type of spaciousness, I think, should be there. So then you can work with space, because that's what you're doing as a songwriter. You don't want to fill it all in. You're working with space. You're working with emptiness. So dedicated spaces. I love that. Hyper specific, which I love. This is not where I edit. This is where I write. And then this is where I edit. This is where I proofread. This is where, you know, I do revisions. To do that is really, I think, so helpful. And then sometimes if you're just kind of the intuition will kind of give you a sense. If you're kind of collaborating with whatever this thing that we're not calling inspiration, let's say, but we're calling working. Okay, I'm going to work right now. I'm kind of collaborating with working. What's going to happen? I don't know. So that's already a collaboration. There's some mystery involved, right? And where that wants to emerge, it's not exactly, you can't really force certain spots. And sometimes, and now tell me if you can relate to this, I'll find myself, I've got a little tatami mat and it's just right on the floor in front of me by the left bookshelf where I would never normally sit. Something's just saying like, that's where you got to sit. That's where you got to sit. That feels right to sit and then do some writing. Or it'll be in the back of the house by the loquat tree. Something is saying under that, that's a good place to edit some of the stuff. So, you know what I mean? I think like with every body of work, so either every album or every book, those designated spots do shift, at least for me. And I think that is so weird.
Mm-hmm.
But I think having, those dedicated spaces, if you can do that, is so amazing, is so helpful. And that's, you know, traveling is a great time for accumulation. I look at traveling as I'm going to go out there, gather as much as I can, and then assemble it all in a space in front of no one. Yeah, in a very special, dedicated space. And I think that's really funny. And something happens on tour, though. It's like, you know, because we're not writing. Can you imagine a performance where an author is people are coming to see them write the book.
Yeah, right.
It's never going to happen. And they're really, you know, but it'd be incredible if they could figure that out to just really block everyone out and just really, but, and it's a projected, it's projected. And they sat in the clear evening light, whatever it is, you know, and no, that's not good. It'd be an amazing, weird performance. And if it's something, and if it's, yeah, wow, geez, I'd like to actually see that. But it just doesn't work that way. It's such a private thing. And it's funny thinking of Sigrid Nunez. She has a line in her last book. It says, every writer carries a banner and the banner reads loneliness. And that's, it's true. It's just true. And that's a part of it. And it's tough. And, you know, that's sometimes, so like you said, you're married and I don't know what your partner does, but as a writer, there's a moment where you have to explain that it looks like I'm doing nothing, but that is
right.
I know it looks like right now is a good time for me to help you do something or do that. I'm actually working right now, but I know it looks like I'm doing nothing.
But don't you think, it sounds like we're on the same wavelength as far as that dedicated space, but often I fear that what that does is it's easy to not write because you think, ah, I'm not in that space now. You know, I'm on an airplane and I don't write well on airplanes. I'm in a hotel room. I don't do hotel rooms that well. So that's my fear is that it's an easy way out of it. If you feel like that's the only place to do it.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I have that for sure with the musical part of it where definitely the musical part of it. I can relate to that so much. There's like two places I will play the guitar in the whole world, you know? But with writing, I just got into that thing of having to write every day. So it doesn't matter just where I am, just one line at least. And as a kid, I remember my dad being like, you know, he was concerned because I was just writing and we're trying to have dinner or do something. I'd be writing about what we're doing. And he would just be like, be here, be present. You know, he's a yogi and he wanted me to just be present. You didn't want this kid that's totally like, it'd be probably equivalent to seeing your kid just like on playing video games all the time. Hey, be here a little bit. I get it. You can do that some other time, but right now we're having dinner. Be with me here. And I was so pissed hearing that. No, I'm doing this thing. Don't you understand? I am being here. But I couldn't necessarily explain that. And then some years later, he got into writing and got into writing poetry. He was working on a second book of poems. And he kind of, okay, I understand a little bit more that you're, it's not that I'm writing to escape. I'm trying to be here so much that I need to capture this. But it's a dance too. It's a dance.
You mentioned the floor and I've had so many songwriters tell me in the past couple of years that they like to write on the floor. And I interviewed Britt Daniel from Spoon a couple of years ago, and he told me that he still writes on the floor because when he started writing and he had no money, couldn't afford a couch. So he wrote on the floor. And now he can afford a couch, but he still likes to write on the floor because of that ritual. I don't know what it is about the floor, but I've heard that a lot recently, that the floor is a place where people get a lot of writing done.
That makes sense. We naturally want to put our feet in the ground. And having those rituals are really important. And for example, Stephen Merritt still goes to a bar near his house and orders a cocktail and writes for 8 hours. I mean, writes for 8 fucking hours.
That's amazing.
And it shows. He's one of the best fucking songwriters. It's unbelievable. And those kind of, I have a little bit of a ritual. I'll walk around the lake near my house and then I'll go to this like Mexican bar and order a martini and go to the corner. No one's around and it's around 6. No one's there yet. And I will just, those are dedicated weird rituals of pouring out. So I'm going to do a lot more than just one line, but those are kind of the fun blah, see what sticks. They don't typically, but sometimes maybe 4 or 5 pages in, one line or word will come of it. So that's like a kind of breaking it up kind of a practice, right? But the thing of the dedicated space and the space telling you where to be, and it's weird, it's a weird thing. You find yourself on the floor too. For me, at least, that's how it is. Because I've got this nice desk. This is where I should be writing. And this right. All I've got here is a pen. Look, I've got this nice pen. And a pen is very important too. The pen is important. I write on my phone and I write on my computer. And that's funny how that's evolved. When I was a kid, it was like I had a typewriter. I can't even imagine not writing poetry on a typewriter. That's it. It's got to be a typewriter. And then now I can imagine not writing it on the laptop. I feel like poetry feels weird with a pen and paper now. And lyrics are very good for pen and paper, but it's got to be the right pen. So I go to Japan and I get this one little fucking pen that just feels just right and cool, flows really nice. These kinds of things are so funny.
Now, listen, I tell people in these interviews, I could do an entire website dedicated to the brand of pen, the color of ink, and the paper that songwriters, I mean, you are one of many who say it's got to be this color, it's got to be this type of pen, and it's got to be this type of paper. And that's the only way to do it. So
we'll make do. Of course, we're always going to make do. And we know that this thing called, oh, that's a good line, is going to come. The only time we know it's not going to come because of our pen when we have our pen or when we have our pad out or when we have our phone or laptop, it's going to usually come at the worst moment possible for sure. You know, and it's going to come when that's very far. Something to record that line or idea is not so close to us. Typically, at least that's the way it works for me. And it's hilarious. Then you go, okay, keep it in your mind. Don't forget until you get back home, until you get to a pen and paper. But so it's going to come and we'll make do with whatever we got. If we can, you know, you have a stick and some sand, sure, we'll write it on that. But having a nice pen makes a really big difference. I totally get that thing. It's got to be the right pen. Using a bad pen, it feels like you're writing bad. It really does. Funny thing.
I think about this. I'm laughing because I've been to so many famous authors' houses, you know, and I remember seeing Eugene O'Neill where he wrote Long Day's Journey and Tonight, and there's his writing desk and there's Hemingway's desk. There's no part in those houses where they say, here's where the author wrote on the floor. There's no famous floor. It's always famous desks. Right. And isn't that, like, I'm thinking about that now. It's no one. Yeah, that's where Hemingway wrote Sun Also Rises, on that floor. Right. But so it's so funny that if you were to say to a prose writer, you know, I mean, for prose writers, writing every day is, that's the way it happens. Like, no prose writer will ever say, yeah, I you know what, I just write when the mood strikes. But I think it's interesting that songwriters often don't do that. For songwriters, it is often when the inspiration strikes. But if you say that to a prose writer, let's say, get the hell out of here. That's no way to do it. But I find those things interesting. But the floor, I've yet to read the prose writer who says, I wrote that novel, you know, right in the corner.
Yeah. There is that thing of, I mean, I know earlier I was saying that inspiration, I don't even know what that is. But now and then, what I mean is that now and then when something does emerge out of nowhere, that strange little very rare thing, let's think of it as a rainbow in a blue sky. It's a fleeting and very rare moment. That'll always come at the worst time, is my
point. Right.
But yeah, there should be, you know, more, this is the floor, this is the Starbucks toilet where it's so satisfaction.
The other thing I was going to tell you about my revision process that I've realized about myself is if I finish something in the morning and I look at it later that same day, the words are still too precious. Like, I can't squeeze anything out of there because it's still in my mind. But if I finish something at night and I wake up the next morning, I can cut stuff.
Yeah,
like it's nobody's business. There's something about sleep where I can wake up and I go, are you kidding me? I wrote that. Get out of here. But I can't do it if I finish the same day.
Oh, absolutely. I totally get that. And that space is really, really important. And that, and of course, sleep is the best space. It's the best space. It's the narrative, the line is cut. So you have the, it's the closest thing to us ever being objective. It's the closest, although that way, I mean, you know, people, there's plenty of other ways, but that's the best, let's say. And I've seen, you know, overworking something can be the death of the thing too. And I remember that with friends who play me the demo of the song. It's just gorgeous. And then they'll work on it a little bit. Oh, wow, you got it. And then if you've got the song for long enough and you're just working it, then you hear it again. You know, I'll hear it a year later and they haven't recorded it or released it. And it's just a completely different song. And all those things that I loved about the song are now gone. And sometimes you can fuck up and think that, well, this is good because it's a new chord that I've never used before. This is a new word I've never used before. And we can overwork things. So it's also important to know when to stop. I unfortunately have the opposite problem where I put things out that are most of the time totally not even half baked. But it's a funny thing how that space can reveal so much of the piece. Often I think, gosh, I wish I'd just now, I wonder, after you do the tour for the album, you go, now I want to make the record. Now I can record the record because so much was revealed in the live performance. Oh, I could have gone to this moment. I could use that word. That happens quite often. It's a bummer, but something you just kind of ride. But yeah, the space thing is important. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and again, like it's all about knowing that works for me. And it's something about going to sleep, and it's comforting to know that when I wake up the next day, excuse me, that I'll have no problem getting rid of those words that were so precious to me an hour before. But speaking of sleep, so. And as a visual artist, I don't know if you read this study. So there was an article in the Smithsonian Magazine. This is a couple of years ago about this space. I forgot what it's called. There's a space between, it's not when you're asleep and it's not when you're awake, but it's that space that we're in when we're kind of drifting off. And there's what they talked about was how Salvador Dali would use that space. And so what he would do is, there's a picture of him in the article. He's sitting in this very uncomfortable chair and he's holding a skeleton key in his outstretched hand and there's a saucer on the floor. When he'd drift off, the key would drop, it would make a sound, he'd startle, he'd wake up and he'd go paint. And they actually replicated this in the lab. They found that was an especially fruitful time. And again, it's not in the middle of the night. It's when you're just about to fall asleep and all those things are happening. And there's a term for that space. I forgot what it is, but he actually used that. And the picture is hilarious. But he said, that's when I get my best ideas.
That's either an amazing true story or good PR, you know?
They replicated it in the lab, though. It's crazy. No.
That makes sense. I mean, that really does make sense. That liminal place is when we get out of the way too.
Yeah.
You know, so I've heard that through the years, like, you know, the best work happens when you get out of the way, and that's how you do it. That's it. You just say, just get out of the way. And there's really healthy and sustainable ways of doing that, and there are really destructive and unhealthy ways of doing that. But getting out of the way, that's I'm sure what Dali was trying to do, was that liminal twilight zone between consciousness and unconsciousness, right? The dream is half formed, you can still kind of see it. I was just listening to an interview with Joe Strummer about Dali. They love Dali. The Clash was really into Dali as this like hyper individual and really kind of the archetype, the apex of the individual, the artist, right? And the artist is the individual, right? Ironically, it's about getting out of the way, losing your identity, forgetting who you are, that all the good stuff, you know, that's when the good stuff comes.
Yeah. My favorite article that I would tell my students to read was an article by the novelist Anne Lamott called Shitty First Drafts. And it's a great, it's from her book Bird by Bird. But if you Google Shitty First Drafts, it's on the internet.
That's exactly what we're talking about, is that for he was, and I so strongly believe that when I start to write, I don't think I have any right knowing what it's supposed to look like when I finish. And that article is all about that first draft is supposed to be atrocious. Get out of your way. Don't think about those things. Just get everything down there. But for me, it's, you know, I'll be writing something and the kids will walk by and they'll look and they're like, "Dad, what is that?" Like, there's spellings errors. Like, I don't care about spelling, punctuation. I get everything out there. I think part of it is I'm terrified that if I don't get it out immediately, I'll forget it. But I firmly believe that that first draft is supposed to be atrocious in anything.
Well, my experience is every draft is atrocious, but yeah, I know what you mean. And you know, it's funny, the Chag and Trungpa had this line that Arthur Russell ended up using for a title, or maybe Allen Ginsberg might've told it to Arthur, but it's first thought, best thought. And it's the same thing as saying that first draft is valuable. That first draft is the seed of everything. And you don't know that until you have to finish the whole thing. You have to go on the entire journey to come back to that and go, you know what? The first draft was, there was a lot here. This is really good. And, you know, so it's a funny thing. You can't get away with it unless you do the effort of doing the entire round. So that first draft, you just puke it out and and then that might be it, but it will never be it unless you go as far away from it as you possibly can, trying to develop it. And sometimes, of course, it develops into something and there you go, you get to the other end. And that's, and the thing tells you it's done, which is so weird and magical. It says to you, okay, I'm done, or I'm done enough. Or it'll have, you have to come right back down to that first thought, that first draft. You go, wow, this is really okay. This was it. But I had to make that journey. It's very important to have people you trust to show some work with, I think, it's a very specific and particular type of relationship. It may be a friend, a family member, a partner, someone you work with, whatever it is, but somebody that won't let you get away with that. Won't let you get away with just going, here's the first draft and that's it. Right. And then, you know what? No, this is not there yet. That's, you know, when you're trying to get away with a first draft that you haven't done, taken the entire journey away from that first draft, it's really important because that's the dream. I want to do as little as possible. I just wrote the thing in 2 seconds and there it is, done. I'd love to get away with it. I would love to get away. But then, and it's such a bummer because you're trying to get away with it. And then, you know, the person will write back, you know what? This could use this. What do you think about that? And you go, fuck, you know, you're right. I know you're right. But I was trying to get away with it.
Yeah. I'm going to end with this quote I've got over here that this is my favorite quote that songwriters love by the novelist E.L. Doctorow. I'm going to read this and I want to hear your thoughts on this. Writing is like driving at night in the fog. You can only see as far as the headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way.
Will you repeat it again.
It's so good. Yeah. Writing is like driving at night in the fog. You can only see as far as your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way.
Mm, wow.
Isn't that great?
I mean, that's... I love that. I've always felt like I'm just fumbling in the dark. So that gives me a lot of hope.
Our headlights.
I'm jealous. Actually, I'm like, wow, you've got fog light. You've got lights on your car. Lucky.
I like to interpret that so literally. Yeah, that, right. Not metaphorical. It's the literal lights. No, but I love that. That's what I was talking about is I don't know what the end point is. I don't think I should know what the end point is. And I think that limits you if you think here's where I want to get.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it really is a mystery. It's a mystery to navigate is what it is. And it really is something that requires you're collaborating with something. I think that's why we're talking about it, why we're interested in it. I like to hear other people's process so much, you know, and it's important to throw in that it's a collaboration. If you're sitting there writing alone, you're still collaborating with something. And that is what I mean by mystery. It's so totally irrational, and the world does not support irrationality. And yet it's the most important thing. Isn't that fucking funny? The paradox of that. We don't live in this world that says, one of the, you know, I'm applying to an Indian visa. And there's a million options for when they ask what your job is, and writer or songwriter are not on there. Okay. Those are not things that people, that the artist is not on there. Painters are on. You know, I've thought, wow, none of the things that I'm actually interested in are on here, or the things that the world, the real bureaucracy considers to be of any use to society. You know, it's a funny thing, but you know, just wait till you're heartbroken or someone you love dies. Poetry is going to come in handy.
And that's it for today's episode. Check back in a couple of weeks for a new episode. I do try to post these every 2 weeks, sometimes with more frequency, sometimes with less. A lot of that depends on my work commitments, my family commitments, and also when artists can talk to me. It's not easy to get these interviews. Speaking of interviews, did you know this is a relatively new podcast? I only started podcasting about a year ago. Well, depending on when you're listening to this, I should say 2022. But from 2010 to 2022, all of my interviews were transcribed, and they are all there archived for you to go down that deep rabbit hole. So if you go to songwritersonpodcast.com and click on From the Archives in the top, at the top, you'll see all of those transcribed interviews. I think there's over 200. So go down that rabbit hole. There's a lot of great interviews there. But you'll find all of those there. Again, the podcast itself is relatively recent, so there's a lot of reading you need to be catching up on with those old interviews. Speaking of interviews, if you have suggestions for interview subjects or want to comment or complain, anything like that, email me at ben@songwritersonprocess.com. That's ben@songwritersonprocess.com. And that's it for today's episode. This wraps it up. Thank you very much for listening, and have a good one.